2012. Is it the year of the apocalypse meme?
The apocalypse meme is the idea that at some point very, very soon, the world as we know it is going to come to an end completely and absolutely and be replaced by whatever your fondest daydream happens to be.
That's John Michael Greer. We talked to him about his book, Apocalypse Not. And are we seeing the end of economic growth?
Up until about the year 2000, most commodities were getting cheaper because we had the cheap, abundant energy with which to produce them. Since about the year 2000, most commodities have been getting more expensive, and this is also tugging at economic growth.
That's Richard Heinberg. He tells us about the coming downsizing of civilization and what we can do to survive it. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the clock rang in the new year, did you feel the fear? 2012, the year the world is supposed to end. At least that's what millions of people think an ancient Aztec prophecy is foretold. The curtain comes down December 21st. People have been prophesying the end of the world since the days of Zarathustra in ancient Persia. My guest, John Michael Greer, calls it the apocalypse meme, and in today's world, it's gone viral. But so far, none of those predictions have come true. One website says the 2012 apocalypse is predicted by many great prophets, religious scriptures, and scientific evidence. Oh, really? John Michael Greer examines the evidence in his book, Apocalypse Not. Greer is the author of more than 20 books, including The Long Descent and The Ecotechnic Future, Exploring a Post-Peak World. We spoke to him about that book in 2010. I really enjoyed this book tremendously, Apocalypse Not, Everything You Know About 2012 Nostradamus and the Rapture Is Wrong. It was an immensely entertaining book and answered a whole raft of questions that I've had for a long time.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Now, a lot of people think that the world is going to end in 2012 because of what they say is an age-old Mayan prophecy. Let's just get right to it. Is there, in fact, such a prophecy?
Well, if by age-old you mean 1984, and if by Mayan you mean American, I suppose so. The entire 2012 prophecy business was basically invented out of whole cloth in 1984 by the late José Argüelles. He was basing it on some work that had been previously done by Terence McKenna, one of the major figures of the psychedelic movement in the 60s and early 70s. And what they based it on was actually a little detail of the Mayan calendar, which is very well known at this point. The calendar has all of these different cycles that roll at different speeds and rates and so on. And it is true that one of the larger cycles rolls over at December 21st, 2012. Is there a vast amount of prophecy predicting the end of the world on that date? No. Is there any prophecy from before Terry McKenna and José Argüelles predicting the end of the world on that date? No. There's one reference to that date in the total body of Mayan inscriptions, and it just says, you know, here's such and such date, a certain god is going to descend someplace on that date.
So this really is of modern invention, and yet it is just not even the latest, we could say, but one of the latest, one of the current iterations of something that you say is 3,000 years old, 3,000 years old, and you call it the apocalypse meme. What is a meme, and then what is this apocalypse meme?
Okay, the concept of a meme was invented by Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, a few years back. He noticed that certain ideas propagate themselves through human society the way that genes propagate themselves through a gene pool. And as a kind of a finding a label for this, he referred to such ideas as memes. They're kind of self-contained ideas. They can move from one context to another context pretty much at will. And they spread, if you will, they reproduce by having one person who has the meme convince other people to accept the meme, to believe in that particular set of ideas or what have you. There's a lot of memes out there. Some people think that all human culture consists of memes. Other people have some problems with that definition. But the apocalypse meme is certainly a really good example of the case. The apocalypse meme is the idea that at some point very, very soon, the world as we know it is going to come to an end completely and absolutely and be replaced by whatever your fondest daydream happens to be.
And you date the earliest meme back 3,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Which one was that?
Well, as far as we know, the first person ever to predict a standard apocalypse was Zarathustra, the founder of the religion that's now called Zoroastrianism. He was one of history's first monotheists. He was quite an original thinker in his own way. But he's the first person that we have any record of to say, you know, sometime very soon, my God is going to beat the crap out of everybody else, and everyone who believes in my God is going to go to this wonderful new paradise, and everyone who disagrees with me is going to be plunged into rivers of boiling metal and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's a very familiar line since that time. But he apparently created it, which speaks, for his original thinking, no question. The guy was a very innovative thinker.
So why do you think it came about? I mean, you actually say that there is a psychological payoff. There's an emotional payoff for this.
There's all kinds of emotional payoffs. One of the things that the world that we live in, that any, you know, in any age of history, in any station in society, we all face a lot of disappointments. We all face a lot of things we don't like. The world just never manages to live up to that sort of 3-year-old concept that if you whine loud enough, mommy will come up with an extra dozen cookies. And the promise of the apocalypse meme is that, you know, some point really soon, whether there's a specific date on it, like December 21st, 2012, or whether it's like the rapture and just any day now, all of that's going to be gotten rid of. Everything unsatisfactory, all of from major issues like the fact that we all die, to whatever minor issues like you know, the fact that people disagree with the prophet of the apocalypse, all of that's going to go away forever, and again be replaced by whatever the favorite daydream happens to be, whether that's, you know, the Space Brothers landing, whether that's everybody who ever made fun of you being wiped out, stomped by the Antichrist, whatever it is. You know, whether it's being able to blaze away at full auto at hordes of advancing zombies, you know, so many survivalists seem to think, it's always a daydream. And the promise of apocalypse is that could become real.
Yeah, and yet here are really two completely opposite ideas in a way. There's the apocalyptic idea, and then it is paired with this millennial idea,
mm-hmm.
the idea of rescue by a messiah, rescue by some outside force.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not just about destruction and ruin.
It's also about the daydream that comes after.
Right.
And the two are almost always paired. And it usually works out to everybody you don't like, everyone who you have a grudge against gets stomped, and you and the people who agree with you get patted on the head and taken to paradise.
Right. Now, you also connect this very much with Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about how Judaism became a millennial religion, and, you know, we're talking about way back then. We're not talking about now, when it still is a millennial religion.
It's been one for some thousands of years. The thing about Judaism is that back in the day, back when the kingdoms of Judah and Israel were little bitty kingdoms in part of, you know, what's now the Middle East, middle of nowhere, you know, when they were two of hundreds of basically cookie-cutter kingdoms, each of which had their own god, or goddess, or maybe a couple of gods, or maybe a couple, you know, what have you. But they each had their own little national religion. They had their little national temple. They had their own, you know, precarious independence. And the people of Israel and Judah were no different from any of these others. It so happened that in one of the shifts between the big empires in that day, the people of Judah were deported. Israel had been taken out some years previously, but the people of Israel were deported by the Babylonian Empire. They were marched off to basically internment camps, a lot of them, off by Babylon. And there they sat, but before they ended up just kind of losing hope and dissolving into the local population, the Babylonian Empire fell, the Persians took over. The Persian Empire invaded, Babylonian Empire was destroyed, the Persians absorbed most of the Middle East, and the Persians were devout Zoroastrians. The Persians also were frankly smarter at politics than the Babylonians had been. They looked at, you know, the interned Jews and the various other people who'd been hauled away to internment camps and said, you know, we could get ourselves some really a lot of immediate goodwill from the people. Why don't we let all of you guys go home? Now, that's of course, put the Persians up one very large notch in the eyes of the people of Judea who were able to return from exile. And Persia was the big nation in those days. I mean, Persian culture was as popular as blue jeans and rock music are in the rest of the world today. And so what happened was that Judaism, the traditional tribal religion of the old Israelites, kind of morphed over and borrowed a lot of ideas from Zoroastrianism. And one of those ideas was the apocalypse, the idea there would be a Messiah. There would be, you know, the Messiah will come one of these days, and then everything will be wonderful forever. And that was probably a very important belief for Judaism to absorb, because it certainly helped them deal with the next, you know, 2,500 years of nasty history. But it also actually helped cause some of that nasty history, as when the Jewish people kept on revolting against the Romans, convinced that the Messiah was going to rescue them. And, of course, he didn't.
So you talk, for example, about Masada.
Mm-hmm.
Say a little bit about that.
The Jewish-Roman War, from, what was it, 66 to 72 CE, the Jews were convinced that God would defend them against the Romans. They would simply have to rise and overthrow the Roman yoke, and then the Romans would be, you know, swept away by you know, divine vengeance. And it didn't work. The Jews did rise. There was people were up to their eyeballs in apocalyptic thinking at that time, and they rose up in revolt, and the Romans started sending in legions, and it just kind of spiraled downhill from there, and a very large number, very large fraction of the total Jewish population was simply annihilated. Most of the rest were sold into slavery or driven into exile. It was not a success.
Mm. And actually, you say that was one successful prophecy that was made in the book of Revelation.
Well, actually, that was in the three synoptic gospels in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where Jesus of Nazareth, you know, sitting on the Hill of Olives, looking down on the temple, says, that temple is going to be completely destroyed. The people of Israel are going to be massacred. When this thing starts, head for the hills now. Don't stop to even to gather stuff up. Get out, because this is all going to be completely leveled, and some of you people who are listening to me will still be alive when it happens. He was dead right. All of that happened. You know, as prophecies go, it was a score. The book of Revelations is in some ways even more impressive because, you know, was written, what, around 70 AD? And John of Patmos, the guy who wrote it, predicted the fall of Rome. Nobody was predicting the fall of the Roman Empire in those days, but John of Patmos did. He predicted that there would be earthquakes, there would be epidemics, there would be invasion by, you know, the terrifying horsemen from the east, think Attila the Hun. And, you know, and then the Roman Empire would fall, and Christianity, this despised little sect, would basically rule the world. He predicted that, and it happened, which is also very impressive.
We're talking with John Michael Greer about his newest book, Apocalypse Not. In it, he says that everything you know about 2012, Nostradamus, and the rapture is wrong. You know, your book, I think, very convincingly lays out the false prophecies that have been made. I mean, the world is not over yet, and there have been plenty of prophecies of its end, and yet here are some successful ones. You yourself are involved in a spiritual tradition of Wicca. Not Wicca?
No, I'm not a Wiccan. I am a Druid. It's a very different thing.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, do tell.
That's a little like in thinking that the Mormons and the Muslims are the same faith.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, there are certain similarities that focus on nature spirituality and things like that, but they actually come from very different sources, and it's a common confusion, but there are a lot of differences. We don't have a lot of prophecies in Druidry. Why that should be, I don't know. But, I mean, the old Celtic myths somehow managed to get by without predicting the end of the world.
Well, what do you think? I mean, is there in Druidism, I mean, is there a practice of magic in Druidism?
Yes. The art and science of causing change in consciousness in accordance with will.
Okay. Well, actually, could you say a little bit more about that?
Oh, very simple. A lot of people misunderstand magic. A lot of people are very caught up in what I call the Harry Potter version of magic. You get a wand and you wave it around and babble some words in ungrammatical Latin and impossible things happen. And, you know, we grow up thinking that that's magic and we grow up thinking that magic doesn't work. And if that's what you think of as magic, you're quite right. It doesn't work. I promise you, you can wave a wand all day and babble bad Latin and nothing much will happen other than a sore throat. But what's actually going on in the old magical traditions is a very sophisticated set of ways for working with the conscious and non-conscious minds using symbolism, ritual, psychodrama, things like this. You know, because so much of what we experience in life is mediated by our own emotional states, our own attitudes, our own psychological conditions. Those are completely open to change, but we don't realize that. You know, somebody says, I'm a failure. They're casting a curse on themselves. Mm-hmm. You can take that state of consciousness and, quote, remove the curse, unquote, change their self-image, change that by, again, symbolic and ritual means. You've removed a curse from them. You have performed a magical act.
So it's not actually changing things in the external reality, although that may happen.
That usually happens because mm-hmm. there's always a feedback loop between our internal reality and our external reality. There's always a conversation going on between us and other people, verbally, non-verbally, but between us and all kinds of phenomena. We interact constantly with our environment, so our internal state very powerfully influences how the external world responds to us.
So I don't know if this is going to go along in the direction of what I was going to ask, but
well, go ahead.
I have had the experience of being, of kind of knowing the future. Mm-hmm. Not all the time. Mm-hmm. Certainly
no,
been
you,
wrong.
You have this sudden, I know what's going to happen. You know,
yeah.
I know that so-and-so is about to call me on the phone.
Well, yeah, from that to I saw the Twin Towers fall 10 years before they did.
I know half a dozen other people who had the same experience.
In a vision, and, you know,
yeah.
And it's not something I just kept to myself. I told my family, and
yeah.
So when it actually happened, they came back to me and said, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I know somebody who was haunted by nightmares for years where there was this horrible tearing noise and a sense of something falling and collapsing. And when they finally, I heard, she told me, she told other people, they finally played the recordings where they heard this thing coming down. Mm-hmm. She turned white as a sheet and said, that's exactly what I've been dreaming.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I've often, you know, I'm a scientific bent of mind, and I've thought, okay, maybe this means, you know, it kind of has to do with physics, that past, present, and future are on some level all happening at the same time. You're just talking about how there's this constant feedback loop between the internal and the external world.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view prophecy, aside from the apocalyptic meme,
mm-hmm.
but prophecy itself, or the ability to tell the future, or the ability to influence others, or the ability to understand
mm-hmm.
other people's
mm-hmm.
thoughts, some of the things, the traditional things that have been kind of in that
yeah.
package of magic.
Of magic and things like that.
How do you view that?
Well, first of all, it's important to realize we don't actually understand that much about the magical side of life. We have a lot of traditional lore. A lot of it does seem to work. Do we know why? No. Do we have access to the multi-million dollar grants that might help us figure out why? Of course not. So a lot of it is, okay, well, this seems to work and we don't know why. It's important to accept that and not fall into the sort of pseudo-rationalism of the debunkers who say, well, if the cause isn't known, the effect can't happen. The world is a mysterious place. We simply don't know why these things work. We've got some rules of thumb. If we can use them in ways that are helpful, that's a good thing. If we find that putting too much stress on them or not balancing them with the effects of the rational, you know, with the checking with the rational mind is a bad idea, well, that's also something to take into account.
Yeah. We're talking with John Michael Greer. His new book is Apocalypse Not. Everything You Know About 2012, Nostradamus, and the Rapture is Wrong. So let's return actually to your book. How did the idea of the Antichrist get born?
Well, where the idea of the Antichrist came from is a bit complex because it wasn't really part of the earliest version of the apocalypse meme, as far as we know. The Zoroastrian religion has a power of evil, kind of a Satan equivalent, who is Ahriman, the Lord of Evil. But the idea that there was some human being who would be the bad guy, whether the Antichrist of modern Christian mythology, whether the Dajjal of modern Muslim mythology, there are various other equivalents. That seems to have come by later. And my sense, is, as you look back through the record, is that the Antichrist seems to have emerged in Christian legend as a response to the difference between the Christian idea of the Messiah and the Jewish idea of the Messiah. Because, of course, the Christians believe that the Messiah has already showed up, that he was Jesus of Nazareth, that he's going to return again, judge the quick and the dead, and all this kind of stuff. The Jews believe that instead the Messiah has not yet arrived, is going to show up, and is going to lead the Jewish people to there are various versions as to what he's going to lead the Jewish people to. But and so the kind of inferiority complex that Christianity has always had toward Judaism, the sort of defensive quality, given that that Christianity frankly ripped off so much from the Jews, they've kind of modeled this idea of the other Messiah, the bad Messiah, not the Christ, but the Antichrist, modeled it on the Jewish Messiah, the sort of warrior Messiah idea that you get in some Jewish writings where, you know, the Messiah will become the ruler of the world and will make everybody submit to Israel. And that feeds into the long and colorful tradition of Christian anti-Semitism, of course.
And now it seems that these two apocalyptic traditions are coming together with the whole idea of the rapture. And it's not really a new idea. You say that the apocalyptic meme came to America in the 19th century. You talk about Millerism. Is that where the rapture first kind of...
No. Actually, the apocalyptic meme came to America with the Pilgrims, with the first settlers. You know, they the Pilgrims especially were up to their eyeballs in it.
Jonathan Edwards.
Yeah, sinners in the hands of an angry God.
Exactly.
Which is, by the way, very, very fun reading if you don't take it seriously. He gave it he used to go in from places, from church to church, and give it practically as a performance. People would attend the way now they go to, you know, mad slasher movies and things like that to get that rush of fear. He was doing kind of the sort of old-fashioned generic version. The Millerites were also fairly close to the older tradition. They didn't believe in a rapture. They believed that Christ was going to show up right there in the clouds on what was October 22nd, 1844. You know, set your watches by it. So they were actually, in many ways, a lot more similar to the whole 2012 business. The rapture was invented by an Irish clergyman named John Nelson Darby in the 1850s, 1860s, around there, and he, partly in response to the failure of the Millerites and similar groups, he came up with this new version of interpreting the Bible, this new way to kind of extract things. And the rapture was one of the things he sort of clawed out of the Bible. It requires a lot of work to find it in the Bible. You have to take all kinds of verses out of context and sort of patch them together. But the great thing about the rapture is that it's always almost going to happen, and you don't have to set a date for it.
Almost always going to happen.
Yeah, it's just kind of hovering there in the immediate future. And so you get that delicious moment of sort of apocalyptus interruptus where it just has, it's going to happen. It's really going to happen. You can get all excited to bet out of shape and put the bumper sticker on your car saying, you know, warning in case of rapture, this car will be
unpiloted or
unpiloted
something.
Or what have you.
Right. Do you have any thoughts on why it has so taken hold? I mean, I think, you know, the actual Christian right in this country is a very, very small percentage of the population, mm-hmm. and yet I think some huge, you know, percentage, maybe mm-hmm. even a third or more, believe in the rapture. Is that right?
That's my understanding. And the problem is that the rapture is actually a very spooky thing. It's basically a fantasy of mass suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, when somebody tells the kids that grandma's gone to heaven to be with Jesus, most people know what that means. And the fact that we've got a very large number of Americans who are basically saying that things are going to get really awful and then I'm going to die, and then it'll be the rest of your problem. It's like every other suicide fantasy, you know, I'm going to die and then the rest of you are all going to be very, very sorry. This one brings in an Antichrist and so on to make sure everyone's very, very sorry, but that's basically what it is, and the fact that that has become so pervasive in this society is really troubling.
You know, there's an other very interesting point that you make in this, and that is that there's a whole other apocalyptic meme that's current today mm-hmm. that's a technological one, not a religious one.
Oh, the singularity.
Yeah.
It actually is a religious one, but it speaks to the religion, to our state religion, our national religion here in America that nobody talks about, the religion of progress. We believe that progress is our salvation. You know, most Americans do.
And what is a singularity?
The singularity, the idea is that at a certain point in the future, we will inevitably reach the point that our computers will become actually intelligent, and in fact more intelligent than we are. And they'll be able to produce computers that are even more intelligent than they are, and so on until the computers reach infinite intelligence, and then they will grant us all our wildest dreams.
So they're like
Or maybe
God.
Wipe us out. Nobody's quite sure which. But the thing is, people have been predicting that for artificial intelligence since the 18th century. It's like fusion. You know, when fusion power. When I was born, fusion power was 20 years in the future. When I graduated from high school, it was 20 more years in the future. Today, it's still 20 years in the future. 10 million years from now, when the last human beings die out and are replaced by intelligent creatures descended from chipmunks, it will still be 10 million years in the future. And I think that artificial intelligence is the same thing.
Hmm. Well, this has been such an enjoyable interview about your book, Apocalypse Not. John Michael Greer, thanks so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you very much. I've appreciated the conversation.
In addition to Apocalypse Not, Greer has written 20 books on a variety of topics. He blogs at The Archdruid Report. Next up, we talk with Richard Heinberg, who tells us about a real apocalypse that's beginning to happen right now, the end of economic growth as we hit the limits of our planetary resources. Stay tuned. In our first segment today, we were reassured that the world is unlikely to end on December 21st of this year. But don't get too complacent. There could be a real apocalypse around the corner. Financial woes, climate chaos, and resource depletion are coming together in a triple whammy that will change society as we know it. Our next guest, Richard Heinberg, says it's the end of growth. That's the title of his new book, the latest in a long line of books dealing with declining energy and other resources and how to create a sustainable society in the post-carbon future. In The End of Growth, Heinberg says civilization is about to get downsized.
What I'm saying in the book is that we've reached a fundamental turning point in our economic history where we simply cannot consume anymore. Regardless whether it's a good idea, whether it's bad for the environment, we've reached a point where it's simply no longer possible. We've depleted our stores of cheap, abundant, concentrated energy sources to the point where from here on energy is going to be more expensive. At the same time, we've run up enormous amounts of debt over the last three or four decades, not only government debt, but consumer debt. We've reached fundamental limits to our economy's ability to continue growing, and that's going to have enormous implications for just about everything we can think of, because we've created economies that depend on growth, demand growth, and assume continuing growth, and that probably wasn't a very good idea in a world that has limits to its resources, but that's what we did. So now it's time to pay the piper.
Talking about growth is something that runs a political spectrum from, you know, liberal Keynesians to free market fundamentalists.
Right.
Can we get people back to work without having growth?
Well, first of all, you're right that the growth bandwagon has political support on all sides of the spectrum, but it comes in different forms. The liberal Keynesians believe that if we have more government spending, that will put money in people's pockets, and they'll use that to buy more stuff, and that will in turn get the wheels of business going, and we'll have economic growth. The conservative free marketers believe that we need to stop government spending and borrowing, and that will incentivize business to get to work and create more economic growth. If what I'm saying is right, then both of those camps are wrong. And in fact, we're in for no real economic growth no matter what we do. But we're in a situation right now where really government spending and borrowing are all that's keeping the economy from completely tanking. So even though there are limits to debt and we're nudging up pretty close to them, the reality is unless we have some kind of jobs program, there's no strong likelihood of job creation otherwise. But let me just say one more thing about that. I think it's really important that the jobs program be devoted to creating infrastructure that will carry us into and through this period of economic transition where we're moving away from cheap fossil fuel energy. If we're simply, rebuilding bridges and building more highways with the expectation that the next couple of decades are going to look like the last couple of decades, we are wasting a historic opportunity. We need very different infrastructure in our country for the future that is coming our way.
Well, at least one country that is seems to be getting that lesson to a certain degree is China. What about the emerging economies of China, India, and Brazil? I mean, certainly they're growing like gangbusters.
Right. Well, each of these is a somewhat different case. China and India share one characteristic in common. They are coal-based economies. Both of those nations get about 80% of their electricity from coal and about 70% of their total energy from coal. What we've done over the last few decades is outsource not only jobs and production, but also energy use and environmental damage. So the Chinese get inflation, they get horrific environmental problems, and they also are burning up their coal very rapidly. So they're sitting on an economic and ecological time bomb. When we talk about the Chinese economy and its 10% per year growth rate, very often people think, well, this is an economic miracle, and by the middle of the century, China will be, you know, the world's greatest economy, and the future belongs to the Chinese. I don't see things that way. It looks to me more as though China and, to a certain extent, also India. Brazil's a different story. We could talk about Brazil separately. But China and India are on the fast track to ecological and economic ruin.
Richard Heimberg. We'll talk more about his latest book, The End of Growth, after the break.
Today I am a small blue thing, like a marble or an eye, with my knees against my mouth. I am perfectly round. I am watching you. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Just before the break, our guest Richard Heimberg was saying that China and India are on the fast track to ecological and economic ruin. I asked Heimberg whether, given the huge environmental cost of growth, is growth good or bad?
Well, you know, it's an inevitable thing. Nothing grows forever on a finite planet. A colorful little image that I sometimes use is that of a hamster. You know, a baby hamster, when it's first born, will double its weight every week for the first several weeks. Now, if a baby hamster were to continue doubling its weight every week for a whole year, at the end of just 1 year, we'd have a 9 billion ton hamster. Of course, that's never going to happen because in real life, hamsters stop growing after they reach a certain size. But we've created this economic system that believes that growth can go on forever. Now, even at just 2.5% per year growth, which everyone thinks of as perfectly normal, an economy doubles in size every 25 years. So after 25 years, we have an economy twice the size. After 50 years, we have an economy four times the original size. After 75 years, eight times the original size. Well, this can go on for a century or so, and it has. But beyond that, we get to a point where the economy's appetite for natural resources just can no longer be satisfied. And we're at that point now. This situation should have been foreseen a long time ago. And in fact, a number of resource analysts have been predicting this for at least three decades.
A previous book of yours is called Peak Everything. And, you know, you've been talking about peak oil for a long time as well. So sketch out for us this scenario of resource depletion, and how much across the board is it?
We are depleting every economically significant non-renewable resource on the planet. And many renewable resources are being stressed, including wild ocean fish and old-growth forests. What's happening with non-renewable resources is particularly significant. Among those, of course, is oil, which we depend upon for close to 100% of our transport fuel. And therefore, oil is central to our global economy. Without oil, we have no fast-paced transportation networks. The economy grinds to a halt almost immediately. We're not about to run out of oil. What's happening with oil is we're using the low-hanging fruit first. We found giant pools of high-quality, cheaply accessed oil back in the early part of the 20th century. We're not finding those anymore. These days, we're having to drill in a mile or two of ocean water or use very low-grade resources like the tar sands in Canada. That means production costs are higher, exploration costs are higher, and environmental impacts are higher. And sooner or later, somebody has to pay for those impacts. The same principle holds for other non-renewable resources as well. We are accustomed to thinking that we have almost unlimited coal supplies, but actually what's happening is, once again, we're extracting the best, cheapest, highest quality stuff first and leaving the nasty, dirty stuff for later. And with coal also, it's already later. Even though the U.S. is mining more coal today than it was a decade ago, it's getting less energy from the coal that it's mining because we're having to produce lower and lower quality resources. And as costs of energy are increasing, that's forcing up the cost of resource extraction and refining for other minerals and metals. Everything from antimony to zinc, including copper ore, bauxite for aluminum, indium, gallium, rare earth minerals, the kinds of minerals that are useful in the computer industry and even in the renewable energy industry, all of these are getting more scarce and expensive as we have to use more energy, more expensive energy also, to dig deeper and refine lower-grade ores. So up until about the year 2000, most commodities were getting cheaper because we had the cheap, abundant energy with which to produce them. Since about the year 2000, most commodities have been getting more expensive, and this is also tugging at economic growth and making it more and more difficult for the economy to expand.
We're talking with Richard Heinberg about his latest book, The End of Growth. You have talked here about resource depletion, and this is a very scary scenario because not only are, you know, as you pointed out, some of the resources we need for sustainable, renewable energy getting rare, but the cost of extraction is getting greater. How are we going to pay for the transition we're going to need in order to survive the climate catastrophe that's bearing down on us?
Well, we're not going to be able to afford to pay for it the way we would like to. Many people believe that we'll be able to substitute our way out of this problem. We'll just, you know, adopt renewable energy sources, and life will go on pretty much the way it has. The economy will keep growing, and so on. The reality is that the alternative energy sources available to us do not have the kinds of characteristics that we've been accustomed to with cheap fossil fuels. And they won't support the kind of fast-paced, globalized, consumer-led economy that we currently have. So as we adapt to the end of growth, we're going to have to downsize just about every aspect of human society. We're going to have to get used to being less mobile, to traveling less and shorter distances. We're going to have to get used to sourcing our food from closer by, and our food is going to be more expensive in relative terms. We're going to have to get used to, in fact, relocalizing almost every aspect of our economy. That's not to say that trade won't continue in some form. After all, human beings have been trading for many thousands of years. But the scope of trade is going to decline, and that's actually going to create some opportunities for the revitalization of local manufacture and also of trades having to do with the repair and refurbishing of existing infrastructure and machinery. We've gotten used to just throwing things away and replacing them. In the future, we're going to be making things that are higher quality, things that are intended to serve us for a whole lifetime and more. And we will need more specialists in repairing and refurbishing the things that we do have.
I mean, we're even running out of iron, you know, things that past pre-fossil fuel societies had plenty of. How are we going to do what we need to do with even things that we have run out of that previous generations before us, even at a simpler lifestyle, had more of?
Right. Well, we're not actually running out of any of these things. For example, there's lots of iron ore in the Earth's crust. It's a very common element. What we're running out of are the concentrated pockets that are economically useful. And how we're going to adapt is mostly through recycling of existing stores. We're not going to be able to continue increasing the rate at which we extract iron, copper, and all of the other elements that that make our society go. So we're going to have to recycle and reuse wherever possible and reduce the scale at which we're extracting and expecting to extract these kinds of elements.
In his book, Heinberg explores how the explosion of household debt and the financial meltdown have contributed to the end of growth through a credit crunch.
Those limits to debt are endemic and very real. For most U.S. households, they've taken on as much debt as they possibly can. Even if they wanted to take on more, the banks aren't willing to loan more to them. As unemployment persists at high levels, as the value of houses declines, there's simply no basis for more loans. And it's only the increase in debt that has been enabling the economy to grow over the past decade or so. So we're in a terrible bind here, and unfortunately, the system itself is profoundly unstable because it depends upon growth for its stability. And so as growth winds down, then the entire financial system becomes at risk. It is a confidence scheme, a sort of pyramid scheme, if you will, at its heart. And that hasn't been a problem up until now because we could rely upon continued economic growth in order for that pyramid scheme to keep building. But now that growth is ending, a lot of debts are coming due, and there will be a lot of people who simply can't pay.
Conservatives, on the one hand, warn about hyperinflation of a dive in the value of the dollar, the end of the dollar as an international currency. You talk warm about currency wars as well. Liberals, on the other hand, talk about Japan-like deflationary period with the value of goods, things getting cheaper and cheaper. You don't come one way or the other, but I just wanted to ask you, what's your sense? I mean, are these just two sides of the same coin? What's going to push us to one or the other? Can we escape either of them?
Well, our situation is inherently deflationary in that all of this debt represents financial claims, ultimately on real stuff. resources, human labor, and so on. And there just isn't enough real stuff in the world to satisfy all of those claims. So many of those claims are going to be unfulfilled. And what that looks like in the real world is defaults. And that's what the banks are worried about. That's what the financial system is struggling over, both with the European debt crisis and also with persisting problems with U.S. banks. We will see massive defaults in the years ahead, and that is inherently deflationary. That represents many, many trillions of dollars in claims simply disappearing, in some cases overnight. We've already seen that in 2008, many trillions of dollars in value disappeared over a very short period of time as house values declined and the securities and derivatives ultimately written upon those house values lost value. So we will see much more of that. Again, that's inherently deflationary. So what happens in deflationary periods is that governments try to make up for that deflation by, in to use a colloquial phrase, printing money. Of course, the money isn't actually printed on a printing press. It's all done with computers these days. But we're talking about the Federal Reserve quantitative easing. We're talking about more stimulus programs, more government borrowing, and so on. Ultimately, that can bring about hyperinflation. So over the long term, I think both the deflationists and the inflationists are correct. Over the short term, it looks as though the deflationary pressures in the economy will probably win out.
Wow, that's scary. That's like stagflation on steroids.
Right. The one thing we can't count on for the foreseeable future is a stable economy that's actually functioning. And, of course, that means that rather than just a sort of gradual reduction in economic activity, what we're looking at is extreme volatility in the financial system. And that extreme volatility can be hidden for a time, as has happened for the last 3 years as a result of dramatic action on the part of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. But that volatility will, sooner or later, explode out onto the scene again. And when that happens, of course, many people are going to suffer as a result.
We're talking with Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute about his latest book, The End of Growth. So let's talk about the steady-state economy, as you call it. I mean, I think we'll be lucky if we can achieve that, or maybe we'll achieve that after this period of crisis. What does an economy without economic growth look like?
Well, we have to aim for a steady state economy. We have to have that as our goal as a society. And when someone says a steady state economy or a non-growing economy, it some people interpret that as being almost the end of the world because we're so addicted to economic growth. But in fact, it's the normal state of affairs. We've only had a rapidly growing economy for the past few decades. All of the rest of human history played out under conditions of very slow or no economic growth. So this isn't something new. I liken it to the situation in an ecosystem. In most ecosystems, the amount of energy and materials flowing through the system are fairly constant. The amount of sunlight, of course, varies seasonally and from day to night, but over the course of a year, and compare that with the year after and the year after that, the amount of energy and materials flowing through is fairly constant. Nevertheless, within an ecosystem, there's constant change. Some species are succeeding, others are failing. There are new species arriving on the scene, sometimes outcompeting existing species and so on. So ecosystems are always in flux and there are always winners and losers. And I think the same thing will be true, or the same thing will certainly be true, in a steady state economy. It will be a dynamic economy. People will still be inventing new technologies. Some people will be working harder than others and so on. And so there will be companies that are able to expand and others that will fail to compete. The main difference with our existing economy will be that the size of the total economy and the amount of energy and materials flowing through will be constant rather than continually growing.
Well, how does that work? I mean, if it's going to be a capitalist economy, then businesses are going to want to make a profit, and a profit assumes growth, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it assume growth over a steady state?
Profit doesn't necessarily depend upon growth. It certainly will be possible for businesses to profit in a steady state economy. What is different is that expectations of returns on investments will have to be reined in significantly. Just with ordinary economic growth of 2-3% per year, investors in our current economy can rely upon setting aside capital to earn interest and capital returns. But in a steady state economy, people will have to work for their profits, and it won't be possible just to invest and make a killing as we expect to do these days.
So you're saying there's not going to be a stock market, that people will either be workers or kind of small business people? Give us a picture here. And also, it seems to me that it's been more than a few decades that, you know, countries like the U.S. were growing. I mean, in the early periods, the U.S. was growing 10-12% a year back in the 19th century. So that's how I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do you have private property, the idea of profit, which does assume a certain amount of, you know, profit, meaning surplus over your costs. How do you have a steady state? And how do you even have investors to invest in new businesses without having an expectation of a return over investment?
Well, see, all of these basic principles of economic activity were worked out centuries ago under conditions of very low rates of growth. However, we have gotten used to financial practices and institutions over the past few decades that do rely upon rapid growth. You mentioned the stock market, currency trading, and investment banking all rely upon high rates of return. That simply won't be possible in a non-growing economy. So you're right in suggesting that to a large extent, economic activity is going to return to a smaller scale, more localized scale, where profits will be generated by actual making of goods and provision of services, rather than speculation-driven investment.
And you're saying that, you know, a firm will be profitable, but it won't grow.
Well, some firms will be able to grow in comparison to others. Some will succeed, some will fail. So growth will still be a real phenomenon in that sense. But the size of the economy as a whole, the size and the amount of flow-through of energy materials will be constant or shrinking rather than growing.
Now, could living standards actually improve under a system like this?
Yes, I think so, particularly in countries that currently have a great deal of economic inequality. In the U.S., for example, we have where we have our main measure of economic success as GDP. We assume that everyone is doing better as GDP numbers go up. But actually, if you track how people are doing in real terms, psychologically, in terms of health care, education, and so on, even though our GDP has been going up and up and up for the last 30 years, people's actual well-being has not increased. So if we begin to target quality of life indicators rather than GDP, we could have an increase in qualities of health, education, environmental integrity, and so on, even as we consume less. There is quite a literature at this point on the subject of happiness indicators, happiness surveys, and so on. And it's very clear that up to a point, increasing material consumption does lead to increasing happiness. But that's only up to the point where basic human needs are reliably satisfied. Beyond that point, there isn't much correlation. And so there's actually a lot that could be done in our society to make us better off and happier, even as we consume less.
So what you're actually saying is that we have so much excess, in a way, in the system that if we could reorient ourselves to the quality of life as versus the quantity of consumer goods, then we could actually decrease the economy quite a lot and still see an improvement in how we live.
That's right. Take, for example, the little Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. Back in the early 1970s, the king of Bhutan gave a talk in which he advocated a concept that he called gross national happiness. And the folks in Bhutan took that seriously, and ever since they have developed surveys and indicators aligned around gross national happiness, and they've made that their goal as a society. So today, several decades later, even though Bhutan still ranks very low in terms of GDP, it's one of the poorest nations in the world, the level of happiness among the Bhutanese is almost at the top in terms of the world's nations. I think Bhutan ranks 20th on the global happiness surveys. So they have very happy and satisfied people, even though they're earning relatively little. And in the best case scenario, I think the U.S. could accomplish something similar over the next 20 years or so, if we put our minds to it. If instead we continue to aim for economic expansion and returns on investments, I'm afraid we're in for some pretty hard times.
In your book, Richard Heinberg, In the End of Growth, at the very end, you've got some very interesting things that you talk about there, ways in which, you know, if we take the best case scenario here, ways that we can reorient ourselves. Some of these things are already happening. For example, the Common Security Clubs.
Yes, these have recently been renamed, actually, since the book came out. They're now called Resilience Circles. And listeners can find out more about them just by Googling either Common Security Clubs or Resilience Circles. But this is just an effort to get people talking to one another in their neighborhoods about their economic experiences. We Americans tend to take economic bad news personally, and we think of it, if we lose our job or if our income falls, we tend to think of it as a personal failure, and we don't tend to talk to one another about our economic experience. So that takes away the opportunity of working together to solve economic problems. What the Common Security Clubs or Resilience Circles do is get folks together to first of all share what's happening in their lives, and then to begin to share other things, share tools, gardening tools, or lawnmowers, or whatever, share rides, so that we can actually help each other out. This is what people naturally do in hard times, but this is sort of priming the pump.
Well, your book is The End of Growth, Richard Heinberg. While it's scary in its implications, it's a fascinating read. It goes very quickly, I found, as well. I think I read it pretty much in one sitting.
Oh, wow. That's great.
I couldn't put it down, literally. Uh-huh. It's wonderful, and it's been great to talk with you, too.
Well, thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
In addition to The End of Growth, Richard Heinberg is the author of Peak Everything and Power Down, among other books. He's a senior fellow in residence at the Post-Carbon Institute. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.